Dale, 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 dale.
Welcome to the Journal of Special Operations Medicine. I'm your co-host, Alex Merkel.
And I'm Josh Randles. And this is where evidence-based medicine meets unconventional warfare.
The views and opinions you are about to hear are the speaker's own, and nothing contained herein is to be considered the official opinion of the Journal of Special Operations Medicine or the U.S. government, including the Defense Health Agency, Department of Defense, Department of the Army, Navy, or Air Force.
Hello, this is Dan Godbee, medical editor of the Journal of Special Operations Medicine. Thank you for joining us for the winter edition of the JSOM podcast. For this introduction, I will point out a few additional articles worth reading, along with the three articles being highlighted in this podcast. Impact of Progressive Simulation-Based Training on Tourniquet Application Skills. The algorithm used by these researchers provides a great template for additional uses. Unconventional Resilience, a Strategic Framework. This article covers an interesting topic and can demonstrate how important individual and team accountability, flexibility, and mindset are to not only success of the mission, but also how important the mental resiliency of the soft medic is. A brief primer on the concept of neuroweapon for the U.S. military medical personnel. This topic can be both fascinating and frightening. Although Havana syndrome has all but vanished from the headlines, the historical references show this is a viable threat that presents in many forms and needs to be addressed. Effects of tourniquet features on application process times. This research is comprehensive. The article is very valuable to any agency or provider in choosing a certain type of tourniquet. As always, we at the JSOM really do want to hear from our readership, particularly those of you in the front level positions. I will always take this opportunity to reiterate our mentoring program specifically created to help medics get through the publishing process. A select group of editors are dedicated to concentrate on articles submitted by medics and aid in getting them published. Now, here's Alex and Josh with the podcast.
Well, Colonel Godbee, to steal a line from Shawshank Redemption, time and pressure. Time and pressure make diamonds. And it seems that after 46 years in uniform, my friend, the Commander-in-Chief has seen fit to let you separate and go forth and do other great things. And so for those few folks who may not be as familiar, Colonel/Dr. Godbee is the medical editor for the Journal of Special Operations Medicine and has been operating within Special Operations in Compo 1, 2, and 3 for a grand total of 46 years. During that time, he's had 24 papers published and has been at podium presentations 39 times. He's also obviously got his emergency medicine residency, got his doctorate, has a master's of science in mechanical engineering, and currently stays incredibly busy working in the emergency room, supporting his local EMS team as the medical director, and is the recently retired surgeon for the 20th Special Forces Group. We have a hard time keeping up with him with all the teaching out there. And he just does it for the love of the medic. He was the Medical Director of the Year recently for the National Association of EMTs. And he also got the State Surgeon's Award from the Alabama National Guard for the best doctor in the Alabama National Guard for his support with 20th Group.
Dr. Godbee, from your time on the teams to now as the medical director of 20th Group, recently retired, and all the things you've been doing, the Journal of Special Operations Medicine, medical editor, thank you for your service. Thank you for all the time you've put in. I know we've had several conversations, and you're always passionate about getting it right and making sure the medic is front and center in the consideration for the research presented so that when it matters, when seconds actually count, we have the best data to support the practices that we've done. So thank you so much for your service.
And for all of you out there, do me a favor if you would, say thanks to one of the greats. Colonel Godbee is available, medical editor at jsomonline.org. He has done a tremendous amount for all of us because of his experience taking care of all of us and is truly a role model. Well, moving on to messages from the heart, I think we've got some other messages about sternal IOs. What have you got for us, Josh?
Yeah, Alex, thanks. So the article I'm reviewing today is Retrospective Observational Study of Sternal Interosseous Effectiveness in Patients Presenting with Circulatory Shock from Dr. Haynes, Dr. Morale et al. The authors note that early IV access is critical to the treatment of critically ill trauma patients, but that is often difficult in hypovolemic patients, especially those who have suffered multi-system injuries. Interosseous or IO is an option, but this may be limited if multiple limbs are injured. Think blast patients, causing volume infusion into a limb IO to extravasate into the subcutaneous space and not do what we're trying to do. Sternal IO then becomes the ideal target, but authors note that there is a gap in the literature evaluating the success rate of sternal IOs. While most of this data is primarily in either cadavers or healthy patients. This study attempted to quantify the success rate of sternal IO placement in a busy level 1 trauma center from October 1st, 2020 to June 30th, 2021 in critically injured patients. They utilized a retrospective observational study design for that time period, reviewing the EMR for the data of interest. They included all patients that received a sternal IO in the trauma resuscitation bay. Patients were excluded from analysis if they were pregnant, a prisoner, or younger than 18 years. The primary outcome of interest was the ability to successfully place a sternal IO device, defined as the ability to easily infuse blood product or medications through the IO. Additionally, visualization of malposition or autopsy proof of malposition were considered a failed attempt. So the authors found in their data 9 subjects, and 8 were dead prior to arrival, and 1 who expired shortly after arrival. All were transported by the police department, which at this particular level 1 center was a available transport method. All 9 underwent resuscitative thoracotomy, and 7 of 9 of these IOs, sternal IOs, were placed successfully, and there were 2 unsuccessful placements that were visually malpositioned.
Yeah, and I'm always interested, how did that break out between the 2 different models that were used? Because I think their experience is different from our military experience with this.
Yeah, Alex, thanks for bringing that up. They were using 2 different types of IO delivery systems. The first was the Fast One IO, which is an older model, which you physically place at a 90-degree angle with a bunch of these finder needles, and you shoot into the sternum. The Talon IO is a new system, which I currently don't have that much experience with, but that one had 100% success rate as defined as a freely flowing IV fluid during the resuscitation, whereas the Fast One, they actually failed 2 out of the 3 times, and they determined that it was better placed at the head. And the other thing is that with an ED thoracotomy, especially a clamshell, the chest wall isn't as necessarily stable when you try to place that device. And the Fast One, if you know, the Fast One requires a fairly stable platform in which to apply the appropriate amount of pressure to those finer needles in order to drive that needle into the chest. I think this study was an attempt to try to determine for this level 1 trauma center if sternal IO is a viable option for them to use in their setting versus the austere setting that most of us are used doing it. And I'll be honest with you, I don't know what they necessarily added to the data, because the only way they could tell is if the IO was working was if it was freely flowing, and the only way they thought it was failed is if it was malpositioned. And while that is a method, and you can see that, and they did describe it in their methods, I don't think it necessarily captures whether or not this thing was actually necessarily placed. And the only way to do that would have been to have done some sort of prospective study looking forward and actually doing autopsies and looking whether or not the actual device had fired correctly into the space and that they were actually getting delivery of the fluid and resuscitation to the patient.
So how would you grade the level of evidence for this article?
Oh, man. Like, well, not good. The sample size is very small. It's a retrospective study, which has its own biases and problems, which, as long as you account for them and discuss them in your limitations, is good. But I don't think they're trying to change practice with this study.
It's a single center retrospective I would consider it pilot study. So I think it's like a 4- in my opinion. You know, level 5 is the lowest level of evidence, and that's just expert opinion, which is basically garbage. But they were very clear, I think, in their introduction that this was essentially the way that you can self-select a patient population that is already expected to meet demise. And if you can improve that outcome, that's a reasonable place to start with a new intervention, because you're essentially not having any potential to cause harm. And I think that's reasonable. But your point is, it's a really small N.
Well, and that is, this isn't a new intervention. It's just new to this area, right? That's the thing I keep on getting stuck on, is that this method, an external intraosseous infusion, has been used in our setting for a long period of time. And the only thing we're missing is the data to prove that it works. But we know IOs work. We know sternal IOs work. The problem is we just can't capture it where we're at, because that's always been the issue, right? Like, I mean, I don't know what this is adding necessarily to the wider body of literature that actually provides any useful interest. I mean, what do you think?
Yeah, fair enough. So as you know, if you look at the author list, there's two heavy hitters within military medicine on here, Dr. Jay Yellen, as well as Dr. Jeremy Cannon, who if I remember, Dr. Cannon was one of the co-inventors of the Reboa. So these are guys who understand trauma resuscitation. And, you know, I think what they were trying to do is really bring our practice training and experience from the military pre-hospital environment into the hospital, where we've got bright lights and more people that you can shake a stick at in a resuscitation bay. And so I think we deserve some of the blame on this one about why this needs to be, why they need to recreate the wheel here, because we do a terrible job with data collection. And so we don't have a tremendous amount of data to support this well-established use within a fixed facility yet. And so they are really, from a strategic perspective, trying to create what should be that linear data set, starting with retrospective studies. And then hopefully after this, it's an appropriately powered study, because this is not, and they identify that. And then a prospective study, and then maybe a multi-center randomized placebo-controlled study. And then from a civilian medical perspective, then we can change practice. And I think they've been pretty open and transparent about that.
I'd like to see the placebo, Alex.
You and me both, brother.
Good evening, this is Devin DeFeo, the guest editor slot on the JSON podcast. Tonight I have Ricky Ditzel. Ricky, how you doing?
Doing good, man. Thanks for having me on. It's been a while, but excited to be here.
No problem. Glad to be here too, man. Real quick, can you give the listeners a quick introduction about yourself?
Yeah, so I did 8 years of active duty, some of that time with the Big Army, some of that time with the Special Operations Community. I'm currently a medical student now, very interested in going to neurosurgery. You got a particular love for the brain.
Excellent. Thanks for being here. What paper do you have for us?
I have Optimizing Brain Health of United States Special Operations Forces from Brian Edlow and his colleagues.
Excellent. What's so significant about this paper?
So there's a lot of things that are significant about this paper. So wavetop wise, this is the first time a group has put together a comprehensive analysis of the state of the literature on repetitive blast exposure and try to distinguish it from the known pathologies such as mild traumatic brain injury and then the recently adopted traumatic encephalopathy syndrome, which is TES. And I think the most significant thing, and we can talk about more in detail, is that it's the first time that you're going to see a schematic of a operator's head inside of a helmet with night vision goggles on, a battery pack with functional MRI, DTI MRI image laid over that, so you can actually see what these primary and secondary waves are doing.
That's awesome. I'm looking at the picture here myself, and I know our listeners aren't able to see it, but if you go on JSOM, you can access this article for free and check out this image. It is pretty cool. Can you describe it a little bit for us, Ricky, what we're looking at here?
Sure. So it's from the sagittal view. So that's basically you're looking at the profile. So if you were standing straight, you'd be seeing someone looking off into the distance, you'd be seeing their ear and their, you know, their chin. So you'd be seeing the profile of their face. In the image, there is someone wearing a classic cutout helmet with peltors kind of translucent. But what we have is the medial surface of the the left side of the brain. And on that medial surface, Edlow and his team overlaid DTI imagery that they took from their REBLAST study, and that's a study everybody should be aware of. And then they highlighted the hot spots of the openings to the skull. So things like the orbit, the nasal passage, the oral cavities, the foramen magnum at the base of the brain, the ear canal, and then even the sinuses of the skull. And they showed kind of these as hot zones of where these primary blast waves could be entering and penetrating the skull to get to the brain. And then the other thing that they did was they showed the incident wave as like the primary blast exposure in these black waves. And then they also gave us the reflected waves. So you can appreciate where the primary blast is going into the skull and how it's affecting the brain. And then how the reflected waves, why they're off the surface, off your helmet, off your kit and off the floor, you know, whatever's around your environment, how those are kind of reverbing. Now, the complexity of this image is if you don't have experience, and I have very little experience in reading DTI MRI or even looking at overlaid images of DTI MRI, and this is going to be a little bit confusing on what it's trying to tell us. So, you know, take your time looking at this image and read the legend a few times if you need to. I don't know how you felt about that too, Devin.
Yeah, I got a little confused. I'm looking at my notes here. You know, the blue is for the executive control areas of the brain, the yellow and the orange highlights were for the default mode networks. And yeah, I was going back to some of my books trying to figure out exactly what all that meant. It's complex and it's a lot for a little paper, but I like what they're doing here. It definitely gives the reader, I think, an idea looking at, you know, the guys here in a stack. You got the blast waves propagating and it kind of show you how like the number two guy in the stack can actually take more blast than the number one guy, depending on, you know, the environment, where he's standing, how his kit's oriented, that sort of thing. It should give the reader the idea of how that may work and the complexities of, you know, how do we quantify and qualify these exposures. And I think that's what the authors are getting into. Would you agree?
Most definitely. And you know, I for you know, disclaimer wise, I did edit this paper as a JSON editor. And you know, an image of this type, I don't want to oversell it, but it's truly novel. This image will be referenced in perpetuity. It's never been developed or published in this fashion. So it's going to be a really, really important for our community moving forward as the research progresses.
Very cool. What else do you have for us in this paper?
The other things I have for you in this paper is that it's really difficult to parse out the differences between mild traumatic brain injury, traumatic encephalopathy syndrome, and then what the authors are pushing for, which is this recognition of a diagnosis called repetitive blast brain injury. So language really matters in neurotrauma, and language has become extremely important when we're talking about blast exposure and even just using the word TBI. So what I want to say about to the audience, especially when you read this paper and then reading any TBI stuff moving forward or any TBI lectures, you have to really ask the authors how they define TBI. And so this paper did a great job making this table where they tell you about what the difference between MTBI, TES, and RBBI are. And for those who are probably not familiar at all with TES, traumatic encephalopathy syndrome, basically CTE has gotten really popular as far as in the public's eye over the last couple of years, you know, chronic traumatic encephalopathy. And because there's people alive who have suspected CTE, because CTE is a postmortem diagnosis only, you have to look at someone's postmortem, you know, their brain to see if they have CTE or not. If they have these symptoms that are concurrent with their history of repetitive head injury, then it's most likely that they have something called traumatic encephalopathy syndrome rather than calling it repetitive MTBI syndrome. So the language here really matters. They do a great job breaking that down. Furthermore, I think the authors do an excellent job providing use cases for using RBBI versus just calling it an MTBI. For example, they have a great diagnostic risk assessment matrix that medics, commanders, anybody could really use. It's super simple, and it's almost like a duh moment too. It's like someone's been training a lot, and it's been all breacher type stuff, or it's been all CQB stuff with demo. Hey, they're symptomatic. We should probably monitor that person. Hey, we should probably pay attention to them or evaluate them rather than just tell them to suck it up and keep hitting charges. And they try to propose evidence to say why that matters. But I also really appreciate the fact that they talked about how there is very, very little evidence on RBBI. And a lot of this is just the authors hypothesizing that this is a different heterogeneous injury pattern and pathology pattern that we're not seeing in other use cases like MTBI, TES, et cetera. So,
Can you parse that out a little bit? Like what would be those criteria that make it different?
Sure. So what they have here is that the exposure column. So they said that the repeat exposure to blast overpressure events that do not meet MTBI diagnostic criteria, such as those sustained during blast explosive breaching. So if you look over and you think about, what characterizes something as an MTBI, we're talking about a structural or physiologic disruption of the brain function as a result of an external force that leads to at least one new or worsening clinical symptom immediately following the event. So once again, language matters here, right? Like these are very specific words. And those symptoms could be loss of consciousness, it could be post-traumatic amnesia, you might have a focal neurological deficit. Versus the RBBI, you have a quantitative change in a blood and neuroimaging biomarker that exceeds the reliable change index for that biomarker. And that biomarker change occurs during a period of repetitive blast exposure. So it's less about the fact that you got bonked on the head, lifting your head up out of your car, or you got tackled or something, and now you have a little bit of deficit, maybe some amnesia, some confusion. It's more about the fact that you were on the demo range all day, or you ran CQB hits all day, and now you have the symptomatic use case or a symptomatic case. And the proposal is in the future to have great quantifying biomarkers to then say, yes, you have elevations in, the hot ones right now with GFAP, NfL, UCHL1, and then that correlates to return to duty, return to shoot, return to rest type protocols.
Moving forward now with this paper, you're a medic, you're a clinical provider for a unit. What does this change about your practice, if anything?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I don't think this paper specifically would change my clinical practice, but it would change my training practice. And I think by changing my training practice, it could then limit how much I have to do clinically. So preventative medicine is actually a part of medicine. So I'll actually say it would change my clinical practice. I take that back. Is this would just give me better preventative medicine assessment. It would give me better information to give to my range safeties. It would be get better information for my team leaders. I might actually have a higher index of suspicion, or even like a less of a tolerance to keep someone on the range all day if they start becoming symptomatic, just because the evidence they're providing is pretty well written and pretty well supported in the current literature. And you see that in like the McAvoy paper that was published in JSOM and other papers. So it's not going to change any treatments as far as medications go yet. It's not gonna, we don't have the diagnostics yet besides the avidalinity probe, but that's not fielded well enough. You can't use it in the field yet. It's not there. So really it's gonna be a prep med. What do you think?
No, I totally agree. Yeah, I'm waiting. Having been the medic on the ground that was, trying to gather up people's blast gauges, enter them in the computer, de-identify data, bring them together, do it on the right schedules. And, I remember this being it being so complex and such a pain, more batteries to deal with, things that get dusty, equipment to keep accountability of, all good things to do for your fellow troops, troopers. But, it's difficult. It's difficult gathering this data. It's difficult for the medic. It would be nice to have a blood test, put it in a bag, send it off, or run it through an assay like an ISTAT and have an answer. It would be really cool. And I know just from myself, and I can't speak for you, but just having had lots of blast exposures in the past and feeling the effects, and it probably would have been better just for myself to have looked out for this. I'm looking forward to that day when that when these novel biomarkers are or can be operationalized, so to speak.
Me too. And the iStat avidalinia pro started as centrifuge. You needed centrifugation. Now I think it's in phase two or phase three of the clinical trial to go for finger stick. So your dream is slowly but surely becoming a reality, but it's slowly but surely. And and biomarkers is a whole other topic. There's a lot of limitations in peripheral biomarkers, a lot of limitations in that data. If you're really interested in reading about biomarkers, I would point you to, Dr. Jessica Gill. She runs the Gill Lab. She's the biomarker expert, especially in this space. So I would definitely look to her as a leading expert in anything she puts out.
Nice. Thanks. Anything else for us? Any limitations with this paper or things you would have liked to see that weren't mentioned?
Nothing that I would like to see that weren't mentioned. You know, one thing I'll say that I'll appreciate about the paper is that I do think this could have gone to a different journal to reach a different audience. They could have pushed this and put it into, you know, TBI and brain researchers' hands and let them run crazy with it. So I really appreciate the fact that they wanted end users to read it. What I will say is that this is going to be one of those papers that is going to be a little bit different and challenging for what our intended audience is at the JSOM. But I really encourage the medics and any medical personnel that read the JSOM to just take your time, ask a lot of questions, highlight a lot of things, take notes. But I don't think they missed anything. They were really great about calling out their own lack of data. They included a lot of experts in their field and gave respect to people who worked on things. I mean, for the the neuropathology, they have Dan Pearl on here. They got Premier on here, Dr. Premier. They talk about Anne McKee's work. You know, Kristen Danz O'Connor's on the author line. These are all people who are really advancing this field. So I respect that they all came together to push this into JSOM and not go somewhere else.
Yeah, definitely. Excellent. Well, hey, Ricky, thanks a lot for your time. Really appreciate it, especially with being a med student right now. I know how difficult that can be. And shout out to you and the guys at Soft Assam. And thanks for what you're doing.
If you're serious about coming to medical school and you need help and you're in the special operations community, apply for our program. Wear a suit on the interview, and that's the only tip I'll give.
Right on. Softassam.org. Check it out. Thanks a lot, Ricky. Have a good night, buddy.
You too, brother. Good to see you.
Coming soon to the JSOM online web store, the perfect stocking stuffer for the air softer in your life. An authentic Marine Corps medic tactical first aid kit in its own DigiCam Molly pouch includes a blister pack of ibuprofen, fresh socks, and a reusable water bottle. Act now, supplies are limited. The first 100 purchasers will also get an authentic signed jar of Marky Mark dirt used to stuff cavitary bullet wounds.
This med pack was not reviewed by U.S. Navy PMED, nor has any Marine Corps squad leader actually inspected it, said pack, for accuracy and ease of use. At no point should you actually use the examples of combat medicine from movies as actual medical advice, and while said dirt was blessed by our Marky Mark shrine that we keep in our offices, he is not actually reviewed it for proper consistency and anti/pro-microbial action. Only good ones last.
And for our last manuscript this edition, we have got Bluetooth tactical headsets improve the speed of accurate patient handoffs by a slew of well-known authors within this community. I would call this a prospective single center randomized crossover study. So I'd probably call it level 3 evidence, although their sample size is a bit incongruous with that. And in reading through their abstract, what they said is the Committee on En Route Combat Casualty Care recently ranked the patient handoff as their 4th research priority. Bluetooth technology has been introduced to the battlefield and has the potential to improve the tactical patient handoff. The purpose of this study is to compare the traditional methods of communication used in tactical medical evacuation by special operations medical personnel to the newer Bluetooth communication method. Their methods were 24 simulated tactical patient handoffs performed by comparing Bluetooth and traditional methods of communication in a tactical medical environment. Patient scenario, order, and method of communication were randomized. Accuracy and time required to complete the patient handoff was determined. The study took place using a rotor wing aircraft capped at level 2, which they said was APUs only, to simulate real-world background noise. Preferred method of communication for each study participant was determined. For their results, there was no difference in the accuracy of the received patient handoff between groups. There was also no difference in patient handoff transmission times at the ramp of the aircraft. However, when comparing patient handoff times to the medical team inside the aircraft, Bluetooth activated transmission was significantly faster than traditional methods. Bluetooth communication was also ranked as the preferred method of patient handoff in all study participants. Their conclusion is that this study demonstrated the utilization of Bluetooth technology for patient handover resulted in faster handoff compared to traditional methods without sacrificing any accuracy in this particular scenario.
So, Alex, I have some questions for you. And it's from the diagnostic accuracy studies from the Center for Evidence-Based Medicine, which you can find at cebm.ox.ac.uk. All right, Alex, was the diagnostic test evaluated in a representative spectrum of patients like those in whom it would be used in practice?
Yeah, these guys did a really great job, and you can actually see that in their figures about what kind of patient sample scenarios they worked up.
Was the reference standard applied regardless of the index test result?
I had to read the details on what that question was asking a few times. And in reading further, what they say is, ideally, both the index test, which in this case would be Bluetooth, and the reference standard, which is the current communication, should be carried out on all patients in the study. And in this case, they did that quite well, and they actually randomized it so you didn't necessarily have trainer bias by doing it with the standard communication and then experimenting in Bluetooth. Some people did Bluetooth first, some people did standard first, so they actually did a really good job.
Was there an independent blind comparison between the index test and an appropriate referenced or gold standard of diagnosis?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is supposed to be well described in the methods section, and I would encourage you to read through there because I actually think they did a really good job.
Alex, what are the results?
Yeah, so I've got a question for the author about this because I will give them a little bit of a chastising. I'm not necessarily sure that they really have a well-identified primary outcome in here. They talk about accuracy of handoff, time of handoff, and then preference between communication methods. But those all just seem like a jumbled together set of secondary outcomes that were studied. So let's ask the author that question.
What is the measure and what does it mean?
So typically when we're going through our quality assessment checklist, this is where we try to measure sensitivity, specificity, positive and negative predictive value. And in this particular case, we just can't answer those questions.
And lastly, were the methods for performing the test described in sufficient detail to permit replication?
Yeah, again, you should find this information in the methods section, and I do think that they did a really good job with that. We're lucky enough to get some clarification from some of our questions from one of the lead authors, Corey McAvoy, who was at the time a medic with U.S. Army Special Operations. We were hoping to have Dr. Dan Stinner join us, but unfortunately, due to my lack of technical knowledge, we stumbled a bit there. So he's with us in spirit. But Corey, thanks so much for taking the time to share some of your insight and thoughts on this interesting manuscript.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Appreciate it. Wish Dan could be here because he's the smart guy in the room, but I think we'll be able to get through it.
I look forward to the ghost of Dan being imbued through you in your answers. I know you guys have spent a lot of time looking at some of those. But jumping right into it, the first question we had is, you know, we really love that you took the idea for your research from the Committee on En Route Combat Casualty Care priority list. Where can interested parties find that list to review? And what were some of the other items that you guys thought were interesting on that list?
Yeah, so I think really, to start it off, it's important that people across the board know that there are three different committees out there. One is obviously the Committee on Casualty Care, which everyone calls TTRC. And then the other is Surgical Combat Casualty Care. And then the third would be En Route Combat Casualty Care. And I think sometimes, at least in the Army, we're like, oh yeah, that's like an Air Force CCAT type thing. But in reality, the whole committee works from the time a casualty happens all the way through the care back to the United States. In 2021, there was a MilMed article that had 10 research priorities for en route casualty care. And there's some, it's a really great article. I definitely recommend people looking at it. It has like some great authors on it, but one of them was patient handoffs. And I think it's a really critical part of casualty care, especially as a medic, especially in soft medicine, because generally we take a casualty, we'll hand them off to a 160th medic, who then hands it off to a surgical team in the back of a helicopter, who then hands it off to a roll two or a roll three. So when you have that many steps in a process, you're just asking to introduce chaos and uncertainty. So we wanted to like look into some of these 10 priorities and see if there's one that we could really look at and how to make our handoffs more succinct, more accurate, and faster, and just lead to better outcomes for patients.
Yeah, what a great background. And just to foot stomp what you said, for those who are interested, anybody around the world, I take that back, a couple of my partner forces that we've trained with say they have to use a VPN, but anybody with a US IP address can go to jts.health.mil to see the Joint Trauma Service main splash page. And under committees, there is the Committee on Tactical Combat Casualty Care, Committee on En Route Casualty Care, and Committee on Surgical Combat Casualty Care. Those are all drop-downs under the committee tab. And it actually has all the meeting minutes under there and ways to get involved. And then, of course, to your point as well, I sure hope that everyone is tuning in to the weekly Joint Trauma Service Combat Casualty Care telephone call at 7 a.m. Central Time on Thursday, when we actually review cases from point of injury all the way through CONUS Role 4 care to get that 60,000-foot view that you talked about exactly for not only the interventions that you do at your role of care, but what happens before and after, and it really leads to better patient outcomes. If anybody needs an invitation to that, just feel free to hit me up at podcast@jsomonline.org and I can get you connected. But kind of drilling down to your particular paper, in reading through it, I did have a little bit of a question and was hoping for some clarification on what was the primary outcome for your study. It was a little confusing to me on if it was just method preference for communication or accuracy or time.
Yeah, so I think originally we were looking if it was like in a like non-inferiority way, what's better. But the primary outcome kind of turned into utilizing Bluetooth was faster than any previously used handover method. And then most importantly, there was no loss in accuracy. So overall, it wasn't more accurate than other means that we had used before, but it was faster without losing that accuracy. So I think you can speed things up all you want, but if you're not keeping the accuracy there, then it's worthless, right? So the primary outcome was that this was faster, but then at the same time, we did not lose any accuracy in patient handover data.
And then drilling down a little bit more into your particular study, you note that the Bluetooth device was the preferred method of communication, but this is actually limited to a single new model of a relatively expensive piece of communication equipment with a limited battery life. How applicable are the results of your study to the wider special operations community or even conventional forces?
Yeah, so I think right now Peltor is the only one that makes this type of headset, but I think the hope is that more will add this function, because I don't believe this function is some crazy technology. It's just basic Bluetooth and a like near field Bluetooth. I can't speak to the price of it, but I do think it's something that should and could be fielded to the wider soft force, and then even more so to the wider conventional forces. I think, you know, industry could take note of the study, and while it's not groundbreaking by any means, it shows that the tech is utilized and it's important. What I've found, especially in communications stuff, is that rarely does a feature come out that almost everyone is like, wow, this is great, from the medics to the people in the back of the helicopter to the assault force. So it's utilized by everyone, and it can cause issues, I guess, because it's just one channel. But overall, I think it has utility to be utilized by especially the wider soft community. And I just don't know across the board who's using it at this point.
Fair. And speaking of standardization, we note in our practice that there are a number of different frameworks used to simplify and standardize patient handoffs. In the military, we often see this as a MIST or MIST format, though others are used in the civilian practice For this study, what structure was used for your patient handoff scenarios?
Yeah, so we wrote this on a deployment. So we've been working for a couple months together on our procedures for handoffs. And the flight medics and the surgical team knew my structure really well. So we just utilized the cards that I carry. And then my communicator would carry with him as well. And that just makes all the information streamlined. And all the people who are working for us know what kind of language we're going to be using. So the card is in the article. It's like figure one, I believe. And it's just a card that one of my first senior medics kind of showed me. It's been adjusted over the years by different people and added small information here or there. I think actually this is a little bit older version. We added some more things as we've gone. But at the end of the day, it's basically a missed form. It's status, because we like to call status first, and then injuries, treatments, drugs. The only thing that I think that we've added on this is an AVPU for the CRNAs, because they like to have that when we're handing off to them. But I think the most important thing is that whatever standardized format you're using, it's just everyone's on the same page. So I'm not saying that this is the best, but it works. It was what I liked, and I made sure that my whole team was on the same page with this. So if you're not working with a group, like you don't have the helicopters and the surgeons at your disposal at all times, then I think sticking to a standard MIST or whatever is the theater standard is probably the best way to go. Mm.
Yeah, point well taken. And I'm actually looking at the article now. That is a really slick card that you've got for patient handoffs. I like that a lot. And then I would be remiss if I didn't pay homage to my trauma spirit animal, Colonel Stacy Shackelford, if we didn't foot stomp that people need to be training, hopefully with their 1380 TC3 cards, just like you would in the real world, and then sending those into the JTS so we can aggregate that data and come up with process improvements and treatment improvements. So you're welcome, Colonel Shackelford. Got that in there. And for our last question in regards to your manuscript, it was helpful to see the comparison in your discussion with civilian EMS handoffs. Did you find any studies that looked at the effectiveness of point of injury handoffs with rotor wing from conventional forces that may not have access to push to talk or the intercommunication system?
So from looking around, I'm not aware of any studies on conventional rotary wing medevac and their handoffs. If you have any, I'd be interested to read them, or I'm sure the flight medics of the 160th would be more interested. I'm going to assume that 99% of the data that the flight medics are getting on those scenarios is from like line of sight communications with paramedics or from a call through a call center to the helicopter, which I think kind of goes back to the original point. And it's a little bit off topic, I guess, from the study, but the most important thing here is that relationship between the medic and their communicator and them understanding what you're sending and sending their appropriate information up. Because at the end of the day, the face-to-face with Bluetooth is great. And it shows in the study that's the most accurate, but the telephone game really reduces accuracy. Everyone being on the same page is so important. And I would assume that in the civilian setting, there's a lot of lost communication from that, telephone game.
Yeah, I think that might even be an understatement. Certainly in my practice supporting conventional assets, it is incredibly challenging to do that line of sight patient handover communication, especially if you are operating in periods of darkness. So you are spot on that this is such a great priority. We so much appreciate you and your colleagues looking to improve the care delivery and increase efficiency for our tip of the spear medics who are really doing God's work out there. Thanks so much for your time, insight, efforts spent on not only your own process improvement, but sharing your knowledge to the wider community. We really appreciate your efforts.
Yeah, I appreciate you guys having me, and look forward to any comments on the paper or anything else.
Well, it should be a new year. We're going to make some New Year's resolutions that we might actually get this out on time, and I think we will continue to fail in that. But, you know, we're going to keep trying. And oh.
Listen, Alex, the amount of editing I have to do on myself takes at least 8 hours for, like, 15 minutes. So you can chill out, man.
Yeah, well, you know, I like to say you get what you pay for, which in this case, you get nothing.
Oh, God. Go on.
But hopefully everybody's enjoying the winter. Don't forget the Wilderness Medical Society Winter Conference is March 10th through 13th up in Whistler, BC. And obviously, if you're coming through the Northern Rockies, hit me up. We'll go do some backcountry skiing. Otherwise, please, please tell us what we're doing wrong, and hopefully with a recommendation to do it better. We are always available, podcast at jsomonline.org.
This is Sophia Rodriguez, Director of Marketing and Social Media Communications for the JSOM. I want to encourage our listeners to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn at JSOM Online, and to sign up to receive our free e-newsletter on our website at jsomonline.org. We love hearing from our subscribers and followers, and welcome your feedback and suggestions.